Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your host for this evening. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Kara Platone. Kara was a staff writer for the East Bay Express for 8 years, then spent 2 years as a senior editor at Terrain, a Berkeley-based environmental quarterly. She is a freelance science writer whose work has appeared in Smithsonian, Popular Science, Air and Space, and other magazines. She also co-hosts the Field Trip podcast. She teaches at the Berkeley School of Journalism. In her most recent book, We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception, One Sense at a Time, Kara melds complex concepts of biotech and human sensory enhancement to show us just how far modern technology has come and how wild and crazy it's going to get. Please join me in welcoming Kara Platone.
Thank you, everybody. I'm going to adjust this because I'm short. But it is really an honor and a pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club. I'm so excited. So let me just arrange my stuff, make sure I don't knock over the gavel. So because I am a first-time author, it's my first book. It just came out in December, and I thought probably nobody's really had a chance to read this thing yet. Nobody knows who I am. I thought there are probably two questions you want to know. Who are you? How did you report this thing? So I thought, well, I'm a journalist. We like brevity. I bet I can do it in about 2 minutes. So thanks to the lovely introduction from Gerald, you know I am I teach at UC Berkeley, and I took a year off from my job, and I made my way around the world sofa surfing, thanks basically to the magic of Facebook. I would post things on Facebook and say, hey, I would really like to go to this city, and people would put me up, or their parents would put me up, and their neighbors would put me up. And my goal was I wanted to write about sensory perception, but not only from the perspective of university scientists. They're a really important part of this book, but I also wanted to find people who were translating that abstract science into really practical things that were being used in the real world. So I wanted to show you some of the places that I went. So I went here, and inside that beautiful snowy landscape is this mysterious hallway. Anybody happen to recognize that? It's kind of a long shot. That is where they keep the atomic clock. That's where your time is set. I went here. I went to Paris because the chapter on smell has to do with perfume, and who knows perfume better than the Parisians. I went here. This is the Monel Chemical Senses Center. This is their very weird sculpture out in front. They study taste and smell. I went to many, many offices that looked like this Hall of Neurosciences. I went to this is virtual Iraq. I am driving a Humvee through a virtual reality landscape. This is Marilyn Monroe. She's actually up the street from here. If any of you have been to, what's the bar? What's the sports bar that's just around the corner? It's there. This will make sense to you if you're reading the pain chapter. And I went to, I was in LA looking for, I was going to a factory where they make retinal implants, essentially bionic eyes. And I just happened to pass a stop sign that said Percept. And I thought, well, that's a sign. And I went here and here and here and here, and those will make sense if you read the book. And I smelled these things, and I smelled those things, and I drank that stuff, and I wore that helmet, and I wore that helmet, and I wore those rings, and I met this robot, and I met this thing that's going to make that robot a whole heck of a lot better at its job, and I met this ancient computer. Anybody happen to recognize that? Yes, you got it. Say it loud and proud. It's Charles Babbage's Difference Engine. It's the first model for it. I met that very old computer in order to meet this very modern computer. I don't know if anybody would recognize this, but it's part of the Clock of the Long Now, essentially the world's slowest supercomputer. Clock meant to last 10,000 years. I got these tattoos. These are augmented reality tattoos. Sadly, they were not permanent, but they animate if you hold them up in front of a special mirror. They're pretty neat. I got a lot of shots. because I watched a lot of surgeries, and you need a lot of shots to watch a lot of surgeries. I turned a lot of these very neat, tidy post-it notes into something that looks like that, and these neat, tidy reporter's notebooks into something that looks like that, and these, the last analog cassette tapes in the world. Yeah! Yay! Hooray, analog. I had to mail order them specially from a warehouse in Brooklyn, which is where analog went to die. Anyway, I turned those into that. And that is what I did to my keyboard. I don't know if you can see it from where you are, but the keys aren't worn off. They're actually cratered. And I did that to my hand, a little bit of repetitive stress. And I did that to my couch. That's why you shouldn't work on the couch. And my students sent me this care package. And yes, those are socks that say science. And eventually this happened. That's the day I filed it. This happened, which is when you get it back, is the proof. This happened. This is where we meet the giant head. I've taken to thinking of him as Fred the Head. That's the actual first version of the book. And here we are today. So that's it. That's how I did it. All right. So what's inside the giant head? All right. So this is a book about sensory perception, how you experience the world through the five sensory portals that you have. Those are sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell, and how people are trying to hack them, right? So the starting point for this book is that there is no reality. And once you get over that idea, it's just a really long downhill slide. And what I mean by that is not that nothing exists, but that there is no one single concrete reality that we all share. There's only your experience, your interpretation of the world around you. That's perception. And that makes sense, right? Because how you perceive the world has to do a lot with your body. And we all have different bodies because we all have different genes. That affects how your body has been built. It also has to do with the fact that perception is really malleable, right? There is much more information in the world than your brain can use at any one time. So your brain has to filter. It has to take this huge amount of information and make a cogent linear story that's going to let you get around and do what you need to do every day. And your brain filters information differently than anybody else's brain has. Your life experience and all kinds of other aspects of what has happened to you teach you how to pay attention to some things and ignore the rest. And most of all, the thing I thought a lot about is that your senses are limited. There's a lot of information in the world that we can't pick up with this basic human unit, right? So what do I mean? Sharks can sense electricity, right? And we can't. Pit vipers, kind of snake, they can sense the infrared. We can't. Honeybees can see ultraviolet. We can't. It's outside of the visible light spectrum. A lot of animals that migrate can sense magnetic fields. So this is fish, you know, like salmon, sea turtles, even some bacteria can sense magnetic fields. We can't. So the people who open and close my book are this biohacker collective called Grindhouse Wetware, and they are really mad about this, right? They say, look, why couldn't I see a sunset in the infrared? Why couldn't I sense magnetic fields? Why am I getting surpassed by a butterfly, right? So what they're trying to do in their basement, and I'll show you some pictures of their basement later, is they're trying to hack themselves a new sensory experience. They are curious about what we're missing out on. And while that might sound extreme, they're actually part of this much bigger, broader field of study that includes a lot of people who are trying to push the boundaries of what our senses can do. So this book is 11 stories about people who are exploring those limits, whether they're scientists or surgeons or perfumers or picklers or clockmakers or robot builders, right? So just to give you an idea of how this book works, the first five chapters about the five senses that you think of all the time, the ones I listed before. The ones in the middle are about what's called meta-perception or polysensory perception, experiences you have that draw information from more than one sense. So this is pain, emotion, your sense of time, right? And the last ones are about technologies that we deliberately wear or put on or in our body to enhance our sensory experience. So I start with the biggest, most remote, or most external one, virtual reality, which requires you to wear, you saw some of those giant helmets, and usually to go into a special studio that's elaborately engineered to give you this experience. And then the next one is about augmented reality, so that's like smart glasses, smart watches, smart wristbands, even smart fabric, things that you wear on you. And then finally we go back to the grindhouse and we learn about these guys who are trying to build something to put in their bodies. So let me give you a couple of examples of the things I'm not going to read from tonight, just so you know kind of the people I met. I met a wonderful man named Dean Lloyd, who is one of the first people on the planet who has ever relearned how to see. So Dean was born with normal vision, and he lost it as an adult because he developed a genetic disorder called retinitis pigmentosa. He volunteered to be one of the testers for a retinal implant trial. And the vision he has with this retinal implant, so he wears a pair of spectacles with a camera over the bridge of his nose. It translates the camera signal into electrical impulses. They fire on an impulse that on an implant that's actually inside his eye. And they stimulate his surviving photoreceptors. The way he sees the world is in flashes of light against a dark background. They indicate kind of contrast points between where dark and light things meet. So when we were walking down the street, he could see the contrast between where the white of the sidewalk met the blackness of the asphalt. It's not what he remembers from before. It's not shading. It's not three-dimensional images. But it's enough that he can get around. It's enough that he can tell where people are. It's enough that he can identify objects that are in front of him. It's a way, I think, a very powerful way of saying vision is a construct, and vision can be different for different people. I went to observe a robotic surgery. That was, you saw that robot with all of those arms. It's the Da Vinci surgical device. And I watched a surgeon pilot it from across the room. Her patient was about 20 feet away from her. And it was really interesting to watch this in action, and even more amazing to know that she does it without the sense of touch. She has to do it totally visually, right? Because it is very hard to develop a haptic feedback that can let her touch the controllers and see what she's touching inside the body. Well, why would you want to do that, right? One of the reasons is because the thing that's coming after robotic surgery is neuroprosthetics, and I mean implants in the brain that could be used to drive a prosthetic limb. And you would want a person with one of these thought-controlled prosthetic limbs to be able to touch the world around them, to know how tightly they're grasping something, to know the texture of an object that they're touching. Some of the researchers I talked to said the thing people tell us they want in a prosthetic device is to be able to feel the warmth of a loved one's hand, right? Pretty amazing. So that's kind of the next generation of that. And in this book, I make the argument that technology doesn't just mean gadgets and electronics and wearables, right? So I think it means any tool that's used by humans, anything that we've done to enhance ourselves. So the chapter on smell is about a group of volunteers at a Parisian hospital who are using smell to help people who have Alzheimer's disease. So I did not know, a lot of us probably don't know, that problems with smell is the first clinically observable symptom of Alzheimer's. So what the volunteers have done is they've developed what they call a bibliothèque, a library of scents. Those were the paper wands that you saw before. And these are scents that are meant to appeal to somebody who grew up in France. So it's the smells of foods, the smells of flowers, they made the smell of wine. And the day I was there, it was the smell of fruits. So what they did was they dipped the wands, the paper wands, in the bottle, and they would wave it under a person's nose, and they would say, "Madame, what do you remember?" And the idea is the sense of smell is so powerful, so emotionally evocative, those memories are so sweet, that even if you can't recall what it is, even if you can't accurately distinguish what the smell is, it can still conjure up a memory, and it can still be a way to help you communicate with other people. So they encourage families to come and participate in this because, as one of the doctors says, it reminds them that the person that they love is still there, right? So and for the chapter on pain, the one with Marilyn Monroe, it's actually about Tylenol. It's about whether or not you can cure a broken heart with Tylenol, a drug that was developed for physical pain, because researchers increasingly think that the pain of rejection or social pain and the physical pain, the pain of a broken bone, are actually the same to your brain. Yeah, so what they've done is they put people in an fMRI machine and then they reject them, which is really hard to do when people are in an fMRI machine. You know, they have to hold still. And and so what they do actually is they play this game of virtual keep away. It's called Cyberball. And they say these other people who are in the lab are playing ball with you and you're going to pass the ball back and forth. And slowly it stops passing the ball to them and people feel rejected. Yes. And they find that people who've taken the acetaminophen, the generic of Tylenol, feel less rejected. They've also done studies which seem way crueler, where they made people look at pictures of the person who just dumped them. And then they do it the other way around. They put people in the scanner and they administer physical pain to them while they look at photos of the person they are romantically in love with. And I'm sorry to tell you that for this study, romantic love meant first 9 months. And they found that actually love was an incredible analgesic, that people who were looking at the picture of the person they were in love with felt less pain. So I wanted to read you a chapter that's about a very different technology. And I think you'll figure out right away what it is. So this is just the opening. of the book. Those were actual page-turning noises for people joining us on the internets. All right. Oops, wait. More page-turning noises. Wrong chapter. Mike Archer carefully lays our supplies on the lab countertop. A DNA collection kit, a kitchen timer, a bottle of water, a bag of oyster crackers, a green file folder, which he opens to reveal a set of plastic baggies taped neatly inside, each containing a gel wafer the size of a postage stamp. There's also a mysterious device with puffy foam discs on its pincher ends. Oops. These are my nose plugs. Archer mimes how to gently clamp my nostrils shut so I can taste, but not smell. I want you to do a little sniff test to make sure you don't have any air going through your nose, he says. I try them on, and it's like instantly having the world's worst cold. Perfect, he says. The experiment is ready to begin. Behind us, it's a snowy school day morning at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and eddies of kids on field trips wearing borrowed lab coats and goggles blow through the adjacent biology exhibit where they can extract DNA from wheat germ or measure the sugar in breakfast cereals. These are actual photos of child size lab coats. It is the cutest thing in the world. Archer, a retired dentist, is a volunteer, part of a small army of citizen scientists who power the Genetics of Taste Lab, the formal name for our setup on the other side of the glass. The lab coat he's wearing is mostly for show, something that delights the kids. But the test we're about to do is real. And if it works, it will shed some light on one of the biggest mysteries in sensory science. We're going to see if I can taste fat. Not bacon, not cream, just fat. Or more specifically, fatty acids. Or even more specifically, this. This is linoleic acid, which is an omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids for you fatty acid experts, which is vital to the human brain and immune system, and for that reason is something scientists think we should be able to sense in our food supply. If I and the 1,500 other museum visitors who are taking part in this experiment can taste fat, we will have helped prove whether or not there are more than five basic tastes. Or to put it more bluntly, we will have helped show whether there are still unnamed, unexplored dimensions to a sense we thought we already knew. So the five basic tastes are here. Salty, sweet, bitter, umami, and sour. So they're considered the building blocks of taste, the primaries. You can't get any smaller. You can't reduce them any further. Just the way red or blue are considered primary colors. You can't separate them into anything smaller. Right? So chemicals in food bind to receptors that are embedded in clusters of cells on your tongue called the taste buds. And this information travels along the gustatory nerve to the brain. Now, some of you, like me, remember a time when umami wasn't on the list, right? If you went to school before the turn of the century, it wasn't there. So umami officially made the list in 2000, although the concept had actually already existed for a century in Japan. It was discovered in 1908 by Dr. Kikunae Akita, who argued that it was a fifth taste associated with the amino acid glutamate, and you might recognize that from MSG, monosodium glutamate, right? Its acceptance upended the food world, hinting that the taste universe was much bigger than previously thought and casting doubt on the definition of a basic taste itself. And it fueled a quest, which I am going to take in this chapter, to see if there are more primaries. Much like 17th century astronomers who suspected there were planets beyond the orbit of Jupiter, scientists are now searching for new candidates that would enlarge our known system. So fat is championed by a nutrition scientist from Purdue University named Dr. Richard Mattis. And he thinks fat is necessary. You need it for your body. You should be able to taste it, right? And one of the things that confounds researchers in this area is there are actually no rules for what a basic taste is. So Mattis has come up with this very well-respected list of rules of thumb, and here are the main ones for him. First, he says, you have to have receptors for it. There has to be something on your tongue that locks with that chemical. So for sweet, it's sugar, right? You have a receptor, it locks with the sugar. For umami, it's that glutamate. Comes along, it binds with your tongue, right? And he believes that they've isolated the receptors for fat. Next thing is, it has to travel along the right nerve. And this is really tough, too, because fat may be a taste, but it's definitely a mouthfeel, right? You know that viscosity is part of the pleasure of eating ice cream or gravy or something like that, right? So the question is, which nerve is it using to get to the brain? Is it traveling along a taste nerve, or is it actually going along the touch nerve? And people often ask me, why isn't spicy up there on the list of five? That's because spiciness actually travels along that touch pathway. That the touch or the pain pathway. Same thing actually with coolness, menthol, same thing. So it's actually a feeling, it's not a taste, right? The next thing is, it has to have a purpose. It has to be doing something, right? And most taste scientists say, okay, we can kind of break it down two ways. It's either attractive or aversive. Either it signals, yes, you want to eat this person, it's good for you, which is why they think sweet is so attractive because it signals where calories are, or why savory is so attractive because it signals where protein is, or it says, hey, person, get away, this is poison, which is most poisons are bitter, right? He says, all right, it has to provoke a reaction. Your body actually has to do something in response. And this one is hard with fat. And it's one of the ones why his critics say, nope, it's not right. Because they say actually fat molecules are really big. It's hard for them to lock with the tongue, the binders, the receptors on your tongue. And he says, look, in rodent studies, we find that they produce this salivary enzyme called lipase. It chips the fatty acid off the bigger fat molecule. And he says, we think people can do this too. And in his test, what he does is he gives people hard fats like coconut and soft fats like olive oil. And he finds that they produce more lipase when they have to chew hard to eat that coconut. So he says, that's the reaction. You chew hard, you make the saliva, you make the lipase, and then it would enable you to taste fat. But here's the thing we really care about, which is, can anyone sense it, right? And can you separate it from the other five? So that's where the museum comes in. With its constant influx of visitors of all genetic backgrounds, many of them arriving in family groups, which is always great for genetics researchers. So here's our setup that we have. So like me, each participant's going to swab the inside of their cheek with that big Q-tip looking thing that's right there and hand it over for testing. So I actually donated my DNA to science for this one. Like me, they're going to learn to swish and swallow from the water bottle in case they eat anything that's really gross. And like me, they will be instructed to eat the oyster crackers if they just can't stand it anymore, whatever it is. And then they'll try some fatty acids. So Archer opens the file folder and extracts the first of the wafers. It's a gelatin square the color of onion skin, perhaps a bit thicker. If you've ever used a melt-away breath strip, it's the same thing. Instead of having mint in it, it has this fat. And he tells me we're going to do what's called a scaling test, which is I put it as far back as I can in my mouth and hold it there. If you've ever taken communion, it's exactly like that. Right? Don't bite the wafer. And I have to hold it there for 45 seconds. So he says, we're going to do a couple practice strips, and then we're going to do four more that are actually the test. After each exposure, I'm going to rate the strength of the sensation. The concentration of each strip will vary, perhaps including placebos with no fat at all. This is a double-blind study, meaning you don't know what these are, and I don't know what these are, Archer says. All right, nose clips on. Nose clips on. So we do a couple of tests, and then he gives me one. He says, this is the only time I'm going to tell you that there's actually linoleic acid in it. And this is basically to kind of clue me in for what I'm tasting for, right? So this is my first hint as to whether there's something to this fat idea or whether I've joined a wild goose chase. Close your eyes. Just kind of concentrate on what you're experiencing, okay? At first, there is nothing. Maybe 15 seconds of gelatinous blandness, and then there is a wash of something. My mouth puckers. The first word that springs to mind is bitter, but that's already a basic taste, so I try again. Acid, my brain suggests, but acid is sour, which is already a basic taste. My mind flails. How am I ever going to describe a possible sixth sensation without using the terminology of the other five? And here, I have just run into the secret second purpose of the museum experiment. We're not just here to see if we can taste fat. We're here to see if we can describe how fat tastes. Searching for a sixth taste, it turns out, isn't only a technical problem, it's a word problem. In other words, the technology here is language. So the challenge hinges on this. How can you perceive something if you don't have a word and therefore an established concept for it? If you don't already have an expectation in your mind of what it is, a way to recognize it. So in order to recognize a new basic taste, we're going to have to train ourselves to discern a separate, distinct quality in the foods we've already been eating all along. The tongue isn't going to change, right? So now, taste researchers often compare this conundrum to the idea of isolating a new color, which if you were like me, you spent a lot of time as a child blowing your mind trying to imagine what a new color might be, right? So the rainbow's not going to grow, but we might find a new way of categorizing the light, of seeing a particular band as discrete, as special, as something that we recognize, right? So, and there's a linguistic precedent for this, which is, here's a picture of a rainbow I've spent a lot of time staring at recently. So not all cultures have separate words for blue and green, right? And that doesn't mean people who are raised in that culture, their eye is any different, that they can't see blue and green. It means to them they're one experience. One word, one thing, one category in their mind. And for those of us who were raised with a language that discriminates between the two of them, we see two. Actually, the longer I look at this rainbow, the more I start to wonder what the difference between blue and purple is, right? So that's what we're up against with the language problem. Maybe fat has been in the taste rainbow all along. We just don't have the vernacular to pick it out, right? We can't tell how it might be different from bitter or acid. It's a total language problem, says Dr. Nicole Garneau, the museum's curator of human health, shaking her head. And we stumbled on that right away. Garneau is an energetic young geneticist with bright blue eyes and a rapid fire way of speaking who came to the museum after an early career in studying yeasts and viruses. But just putting out a press release advertising the study forced the museum to confront the language problem. What were they going to call this thing? And their solution, for marketing purposes at least, was fatty acid taste, a phrase that is precise, if not exactly satisfying. The problem, as she points out, is that fat taste doesn't evoke a particular mental image. We have no percept for what fat should taste like and no descriptive language for it. So the museum's way around this is crowdsourcing. If all 1,500 of us can free associate some reactions, maybe we're going to collectively come up with a recognizable word. That's 1,500 brains that are a lot smarter than just one scientist. He's going to use some sciencey name that isn't all that relevant, says Garneau. We're going to have something simple that is relatable that the community can embrace and say, that's the sixth taste and I understand what it means. Archer clicks the kitchen timer. Time to come up with some relatable words. I'm not interested in good, bad, or gross, he says. That doesn't tell me anything. So I say the only word that I've got that isn't already a basic taste. Varnish. Archer nods, pushing a paper towards me. Cleaner, I write. Solvent? Not too astringent. Not like, say, Pine Sol. Mellower. Funkier. Next, Archer has me take off the nose clips. The experience most people call taste is actually more accurately known as flavor, which is the combined work of the mouth and the nose. This is a very gross picture I took in a doctor's office. That's what your head would look like if it was split in half from crown down to your nose. So when you eat, food molecules of scent rise up from your mouth up into the nose. And that is the scientific term for that is retronasal olfaction. And the brain processes them in combination. That's why nothing tastes good when you have a cold, because this process isn't working the way it should. So flavor perception can be dramatically altered by odor, so the museum wants to test this too. Let's take the clip off before you lose that entire thing. What do you think it smells like, he says. The scent is already vanishing, as ephemeral as dream logic. Just the faintest whiff of shoe polish, I finally say. So now it's time for the scaling test, the one where I have to rate how strong it is. The first tab is weak, the ghost of wood varnish. I mark what would be a 1 on a scale of 10. The second is much stronger, a 7. And this time when Archer asked me to remove the nose clips, an extra level of funkiness emerges. There's something old about it, I say. Stale air, suitcase leather, or old luggage. And also, is my mouth watering? If so, is it because it's almost lunchtime and these wafers are the first food-like objects I've put in my mouth? Is it the auto-suggestion of the writer who read a whole passel of studies about fat taste before coming to taste fat? Am I salivating because people in Mattis's coconut study did it? Heck, am I salivating because mice do it? I am sure about one thing. Whatever's happening is not fun. On the third try, I actually became the first person who almost broke into the oyster crackers. After the longest 45 seconds yet, Archer finally stops the timer. Definitely a 9. Ugh, I manage. Brrr, which here is rendered as BRLRLRLRGHGHGHGH. I try to come up with some more scientifically useful words. Plastic? PVC pipe? Shoes? I've defaulted to metaphor. All my adjectives have failed. So time for the last trial. I keep an eye on the crackers, but the tab is, I'm pretty sure, the placebo. I sense nothing, and my contribution to taste science is officially over. Which, by the way, they're still running this. You can get in on it if you happen to be in Denver. So, for the record, most people don't do much better. When I ask Mattis if he can describe fat, he flails too. No, I can't. It's awful. Period, he says. It sucks the air out of your lungs. It's just terrible. Nauseating. It's rancidity. It's really, really bad cooking oil, the sensation that gives you. At first, most people default to a familiar basic taste, bitter. But we don't think bitter is actually the word, said Mattis. Bitter is just being used as a way of saying that it's awful. And so he thinks there's a reason why fat should feel good but taste bad. And he says that's because free fatty acids are generated when food spoils. So you want to eat some fat, but you want to avoid spoiled food. So he says he thinks the purpose is actually aversive. Yeah. So in the first 6 months of experiments, which is the results that they had as of April, the most common taste descriptors the museum collected were bitter, buttery, and nothing. And for smell, the top four were nothing, paper, cardboard, and plastic. But there have been outliers. People who compared the taste to rotten icing, ocean water, dandelions, or gummy bears. and the smell to seaweed, pine nuts, stamp books, or bricks. And I would very much like to know how people know what bricks taste like. So in April, they released some preliminary results using data from the first 733 testers and found that so far people were proving they could indeed taste fatty acids. People in that early pool were accurately rating higher intensity in the wafers that had more of the acid. And women and girls were more sensitive to it than men and boys, and children were more sensitive than adults. And they think that variability might have to do with the fact that this is a super gnarly gene. The gene that they think controls that receptor, it has 84,000 base pairs. By comparison, one of the genes that controls bitter only has about 1,000. So that's a really big difference. It's lots of room for variation. And there's another X factor. When it comes to perception, especially for novel stimuli, people are enormously suggestible. Thanks to Garneau's experience studying yeast, she has a sideline working with brewers and winemakers, fields where descriptive language for taste is something of a fetish. Wine has an enormously rich and complex language, but one that's notorious for exaggeration and wishful thinking, especially when attempted by amateurs. Garneau recalls attending a tasting at which her husband, just to see what would happen, suggested that the vintage they were drinking had a gunpowder quality. And much to her alarm, others at the table said they could taste it too. Faced with a blank slate, she says, even when someone tosses out an unlikely term like gunpowder, you're going to latch onto it. Your brain's going to be like, yeah, that's it, because I can't come up with the language. And that's using the stuff we know, like the flavor of wine. With a potential sixth taste, she says, now we're talking about a topic we literally have no language about. So it's compounded. Your brain wants to solve. Your brain so much wants to solve this puzzle of what it's tasting, and it doesn't have the language. So whatever anyone throws out there, you're going to be like, yeah, that's it. So I'll just very briefly summarize what happens next, just to give you an idea. The main things to know, not only about the search for a sixth taste, but everything else that's going on in the sensory science world, is it used to be a psychological science. It was about studying the brain, and it was about studying human behavior. So you gave a human or an animal a stimulus, and they saw how they reacted. You gave them a food. Do they like it? Do they eat more? Do they spit it out? Well, within the last 20 years, it's almost entirely a biochemical one. The focus has shifted from brain to tongue. It's a totally different field with totally different people in it. So that's a really big change. There are other contenders out there. I ran around the world trying to taste what these might be. This is one of them. It's calcium. So there are people at Monell Chemical Senses Center. Dr. Michael Tordoff is their leader, who think calcium should be one of it. There are people who say it might be water, something we need, something we should be able to taste. There are people who think it might be carbonation, and that it would be separate from the feeling of carbonation bubbles. There's this mysterious thing. So this is polychaos. There is pretty good evidence that rodents can distinguish three different kinds of sweet. They can essentially taste the difference between long starches, medium starches, and small starches. So this is one of them, and Dr. Michael Tordoff is holding it, and he says, we can't figure out why this man-made thing should taste so great for a rat. I ate it. It tastes like cardboard. Nothing. And this, you know, I said this was like the hunt for a new planet. This is the Pluto. This is the thing where nobody can agree on whether it's a contender or not. This idea is called kokumi, and it's being mainly advanced by scientists at Ajinomoto, which is a Japanese food research company. And they have stopped short of calling it a basic taste. They call it a phenomenon or an effect, and the idea is it is something that has no taste on its own but makes the other basic tastes taste better. Yeah, right? So it makes sweet sweeter, it makes salt saltier, it makes savory savorier. Some of the people who are looking into it are looking at it as kind of like a salt enhancer. Maybe you could put it in low-sodium foods. And there are a lot of people in the United States who say this idea is bogus, we don't get it. But Ajinomoto is the company that brought you MSG starting in 1909. They have a really good track record for finding basic taste in the face of Western disbelief. So basically, I end this chapter with kind of two questions, which is, like me, most of you probably remember when there was a time when there was only four. So one of the questions is, how do we learn to taste the fifth? All of you who enjoy savory things, umami burger, caramelized onions, parmesan, tomato sauce, how did we learn to consider that a separate taste? And the other question is, how did people in Japan do it 100 years before we did? And the answer, I think, has something to do with this broth called dashi. I'll leave you with a cliffhanger. All right, how are we doing on time? Time for questions? Or do you guys want to see biohackers real quick? Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
everybody wants to see biohackers. I'll give you a warning if I'm going to show you anything really gross. So we saw the search for the sixth taste. I also went to the search for the sixth sense. So there are a sixth sense. So there are a lot of people who are trying to see if you can give yourself some kind of implant that would extend your sensory experience in some way that humans can't normally sense. A lot of these people start with implanting a magnet. The guys at Grindhouse called this the blood sacrifice to the grinder gods. Grinder is kind of a term for biohackers who actually put stuff in their body. So when I went to the, when I first started interviewing these guys in the fall of 2013, this is Tim Cannon. He's the leader of Grindhouse. That's his basement. That is the Grindhouse. And they had just finished building a device called Circadia. This is what Circadia looked like on the breadboard. So the idea of Circadia is it is a temperature monitor. It was going to go in his arm. It was going to take his temperature, read that information out, and port it to his phone. Now, that's not necessarily a sensory experience. That's more of kind of a functional experience. And they were doing this basically as a demo to see, first of all, if they would end up killing Tim. Right? Would he have a massive infection? Would his body reject it? Would it breach? Would something bad happen? And then they were going to try to build other things after it. So that's Circadia on a breadboard. That is Circadia inside a silicone encasement. For reference, that's about the size of a deck of cards. And now I'm going to show the thing. If you are sensitive at all to the idea of this being in a person's arm, don't look. That's what it looks like in Tim's arm. Yeah. And this, if I can get this to play, is what it does. So he's holding a charging coil up to it, and it lights up to show that it's receiving the charge. And, yeah, I turned the sound off because the audio is very poor, but this was right before Christmas, and what's happening is somebody is humming Jingle Bells, and Tim is saying, well, I'm a festive guy. So that's Circadia. So they had successfully done this. The book opens with us going to Radio Shack in the mall for him to get supplies for his next project, which is this. And actually, this was my biggest fear about the book, is that Radio Shack would go out of business before the book published, and then everything would be out of date from sentence one. So this was their idea for their next project. It's called North Star. And the idea of North Star is to essentially put a compass in their hand. So the idea is that it would go in the back of the hand, and it would light up. And it would light up when you face north. So this is what it looked like on the breadboard while I was there. These images are courtesy of them, which they've sent me recently. So this is their first manufactured version. You can see that it's about the size of a quarter. This is the implantable version that's encased in silicon. And I'll just warn you again, in case you're sensitive to seeing things in the body, this is what it looks like in somebody's hand. So this version, which they successfully implanted in five or six people right before Thanksgiving, only lights up. It doesn't have the compass element in it. So they're halfway there, but they're not all the way there. So that's the latest on my friends at the Grindhouse. And that's it. I'd be happy to take some questions if you have any. Thank you so much. Right. Do you want to come use this one?
There we go. Okay. Our thanks to Kara Platone. Please join me again in thanking her.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for coming out on a Wednesday, too. Yeah.
We would like our listening audience to know that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. And now we will open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, either you can raise your hand, you can come to the mic, and go for it.
Okay. Hi. Great presentation.
Thanks.
My name is Hunter Whitney. I do data visualization and user experience design. And one of the reasons I came tonight, it's a very intriguing topic, is thinking about extra senses for dealing with all the extra information, all the extra data that we're being bombarded with. Right now, I work with a very narrow palette of mostly visual types of displays, but I'm really interested in expanding that range with things like haptics and 3D and so forth, interaction and all these things, maybe even sense and other things. So do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. First of all, you have a cool job. That sounds awesome.
I like it.
One of the things people were telling me when I was researching, particularly the augmented reality chapter, but also the chapter on telesurgery, is people were saying the visual channel is overloaded. We're putting too much information in our eyes. People can't pay that much attention to it. You know, with things like augmented reality spectacles, there are a lot of concerns about distraction and seasickness and people not being able to concentrate because there's too much information coming at them. So I in this book, I don't delve too much into the solutions because it's a little bit off topic, but there were some kind of cool ideas people threw at me. For example, for the surgeon who's operating remotely on her patient, one of the mechanical engineers I spoke with said, okay, what if So she's driving these robotic arms with her arms. What if there's a third automated arm? And the way the third automated arm is interacting with her is it's touching her somewhere on her body, either maybe on one of the planes of her arms or on her foot, and that's giving her information about what she's doing. So we're not rendering that information to her through her eyes or through her fingers, which are otherwise occupied. In the augmented reality chapter, I went to London to meet with Adrian David Chiok, who's an augmented reality researcher who works in smell, taste, and touch. He had a lot of interesting ideas about how to convey experience at a distance using these senses. Because, again, he kind of thought, okay, there's too much focus on vision. I went to Disney Research, and I saw a project that has been, to my understanding, it's been discontinued because the scientists moved to Google to work on Project Jacquard, which is their project that has to do with weaving electronic fibers into fabric so that your clothing becomes your interface for driving a computerized device. And he was using air as an augmented reality method of communication. So he had developed devices that would blow air at you, and so you would have these feelings of things moving around you or of touching things you weren't really touching. One of the really cool demos that they had was they had these... they would project an image of a butterfly down from the ceiling, and you could put your hand under it, and they would force air that had been timed to match the flapping of the butterfly's wings at you. So it would feel and look to you as though a butterfly was landing on your palm. So I do think there are people who are working on it, but I really think the eyes dominate everything right now.
Yeah.
Thanks for the question.
Hi. I'm Damara Arrowood, and I'm building a company working with scientific data visualization. And I was curious, have you done any work, as you were saying, you know, we're being bombarded by visual data. Have you done anything where there's an integration with sound? Where sound is actually, it's sonified data integrating with visual data. That's one. And two, have you done any projects with NASA?
Oh, well, I wish, but no. I'm sorry. So sound is interesting. I know there are companies making what's called smart headsets, but I didn't get into that in the book. The augmented reality world is so big and all over the place, and the smart headset people were in Europe, and I couldn't get to them. One of the things I do know is, have you heard of Neil Harbison? He's one of the first people to kind of hang out his shingle as a professional cyborg, and he has this thing that's called his iBorg. Which is an antenna that he's built. He is colorblind, and it translates color information into sound, so he can listen to sound. Yeah, and he's been doing this for years. So that's one of the first things that I can think of. But it's nice to meet you. I love your Twitter feed. I feel like we live in this virtual world where we kind of know people through the internet. It's cool when they turn up in real life.
Let me squeeze in a question here.
Sure.
Is there any of this kind of work being done to augment human capability in terms of task? It seems like a lot of it is changing perception, but will we be able to do different things? I don't mean like flying or anything, but actually do different things from enhanced perception.
I was looking primarily at basically the way the brain works is you have input and you have output, right? So perception is all about information going in, and I was looking at that side of the brain. There are a lot of people who look at the motor side, outbound signal, but that is a second book. I think the closest I got to it was with neuroprosthetics and the idea of achieving harmony between the outbound signal, which is I would like to move my arm, and the inbound signal, which is where is it in space, what am I touching, that sort of thing. The trick for that is synchronicity, right? Because you have to have them timed perfectly so that everything makes sense, that the information is all congruent. That's very hard. It's this kind of ballet that you would have to achieve. So I was really only looking at one side of it. I know people are doing cool things with exoskeletons and all these things to augment what people can do and how we can move, but maybe in the next project.
Hi, Emma. I'm
with you. It's hard to talk into these things.
I know, and I'm short too, so
yeah.
Vertically challenged. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. My name is Bridget McGraw, and I did a thesis project at NYU simulating navigation with your sense of smell back in 94.
Wow.
And it was hard then. And now I'm teaching Internet of Things to high school kids. So... my question for you is, I feel that scent and sound can be really invasive. Mm-hmm. I mean, noise pollution, and I can't sit next to people who are wearing strong perfume sometimes. So do you see any movement toward, like, containing scent and sound?
This is very interesting. Wow, you have a cool job, too. Everybody in this room has cool jobs.
Yeah.
So one of the problems with rendering smell at a distance is that it goes everywhere, right? And then you can't stop it. This is why we don't really have smell-o-vision. You know, they've tried it in theaters and stuff like that, but the problem is you release one scent and then it doesn't go away. So I understand
scratch
what you're saying.
Scratch and sniff work, so.
Oh, yeah, see, there's scratch
local,
and sniff.
Localized.
So these are all the challenges for people who are trying to work in transmitting smell at a distance. I would like to say one of the cool things about smell that I learned in researching this is I went to a military base, Buckley Air Force Base, to learn about virtual reality, how it was being used to basically pre-treat soldiers, or the test was to see if you could pre-treat soldiers before they went to battle by putting them in stressful situations and see if that would decrease their likelihood of coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder. And this was built on that virtual Iraq, virtual Afghanistan simulation that I showed you before. One of the elements that they've brought into virtual reality for this is smell. So when people are in these virtual simulations, they're not only watching and listening, they're holding a prop rifle, so they get that feeling. There's a heat lamp to make it hot, and then they're smelling these very evocative odors like garbage and diesel and all of these things. I thought that was cool. But yes, the people who are working with smell at a distance have the problem of it going everywhere, and they also have the problem, which is it's very hard to transmit a chemical via a computer. So Dr. Chiok, for example, he does all these things with the cell phone. So he does things like he has a little scent plugin that you can get for your phone, and then if your friend has it, you can transmit the smell at a distance. So you can text them, do you want to meet for coffee? And you can the smell of coffee will come out of their phone, right? But the problem is they have to have that thing. They have to have that attachment. He's also done, for touch, he's done this thing where you can kiss people through your phone. So there's these lips that you put on your phone, and then you video conference with the person you want to kiss, and then you lean into your phone, and it haptically transmits the feeling of the kiss, right? But again, that only works if they have the kissing lips. Yeah, on the other end. Whoa. Yeah. No, okay, so, and then, have you seen the Meta Cookie? This is this contraption where you take a plain cookie and you wear this thing that goes over your head and up your nose, and it blows scented air up your nose and it changes the taste of the cookie, right? But it's not really unobtrusive, right? So it's hard to transmit things at a distance. That said, so Dr. Chiok, one of the things he's working on is, could we stimulate the olfactory neurons electronically without having to transmit a chemical across the distance? And this is very, very early days, but he said, could we make it possible for you to taste a flavor that doesn't exist in nature? Like, what if we could cycle back and forth between cinnamon and vanilla once every second, right, with this thing, which he envisions as an electronic device you would wear at the top of your palate, actually inside your mouth, and it would transmit electron. Yeah, but it doesn't exist on the commercial market yet. It's really an early idea. So smell is tough. Taste is tough. Yeah. Other question? Yeah.
Hi.
Sorry. The question was, why is that important? Yes. And somebody always asked me, couldn't we spend this money doing something else, right? So I should tell you, biohackers work with a budget of $0. So that money is not coming out of any university pool or something like that. I think the reason I'll say this. There were two big camps that I talked to. There was the assistive medical camp, which is the big researchers, pharmaceutical companies, for-profit. They are doing things for people who have a medical need that is very severe and there's no other treatment, right? People who are essentially blind, people who are paralyzed, people who've had a stroke. They are not doing things for the biohackers of the world who are just kind of curious folks. And when I would ask them, why do you need to do this? Why do you want to do this? They had a wide range of answers. One of them said, look, I'm kind of sappy, and I would love to know what a sunset looked like in infrared and ultraviolet. It would be beautiful, right? Somebody else said, the human body is a mess. No sane person would engineer it. We can do better, right? Okay. Somebody said, why do I put these things in my body? I talked to people who had RFID chips and other things implanted in their body, and I said, look, I have a RFID chip here on my card in my wallet. What's the difference? Why put it in your hand? And he said, because it's become part of my body. It's become part of my abilities, my experiences, what I can do. It's just part of who I am now. This is how I think of myself. So I think people on that end of the spectrum, I kind of think they are modern psychonaut. They are interested in expanding what the mind can do. And I think this is a human thing. I think people have done it since the days of storytelling. You know, this idea of transporting yourself into another world or being something different than you are. You know, people have done it. I mean, we're here in the Bay Area. People have done it with psychedelic drugs forever, right? So I think it's just kind of a new way of doing it. Yeah.
Actually, your comments almost relate to what my question was going to be, which is, how do you see this research relating to transhumanism?
Yeah.
And do you see any dangers or problems for society changing the human body in this way?
Yeah, great question. So I think there is the biohack. Okay, so Grindrs are kind of the electrical engineering arm of the biohacker universe. I think there's a lot of people who consider themselves biohackers who are trying to do things through optimizing diet, through supplements, through wearables. They're not actually doing anything that goes inside the body. And somehow they overlap sometimes with the transhumanists or not. There are a lot of camps out there. But yes, there are a lot of concerns. Okay, so I'll just give you a couple of the ones that people mention frequently. One is, when you put things on or in the body, you're collecting a lot of information. Well, who here trusts anyone to keep your data private, right? So if you are having information about where you are, what you're doing, especially with the biochemistry of what's going on in your body, where is that information going, and can anybody promise that it's going to remain private indefinitely, right? A lot of concerns that came up with augmented reality devices, like, you know, smart glasses, things that go over the eye, was you are now networked to a lot of other people who are influencing you very intimately, right? That information is literally coming between your eye and the world. And that is very powerful. I met with a guy named Adam Wood, who's a leader of a group called Stop the Cyborgs, which essentially rose in opposition to Google Glass. They thought Google Glass had a lot of problems, mostly because of the camera and this networking ability. And he said, look, technology was built by people. People have biases. You don't know what information they've chosen to leave in. You don't know what information they have taken out. You don't know how anybody has curated the information that is serving you, right? And you have no idea what its limitations are. When I would go ask the biohackers, well, what do we do about this? Their solution was always make it open source. So everybody knows what's in it, and if people want to build their own, they can build their own. And I would say, yeah, but I don't want to build my own, right? A lot of people don't want to build their own. And they'd say, yeah, but at least it's an option. You know, and they thought it would be a protection against things being very expensive, and which relates to, I think, the third big concern that people brought up, which is, what if this stuff confers such a big benefit that you have to wear it for work, that you have to wear it for school, that you have to wear it to be a middle-class person, right? I talked to Dr. Gregor Wolbring, who's a disabilities and abilities scholar at the University of Calgary in Canada. And he thinks a lot about this because a lot of assistive technologies are developed first for people with disabilities, right? And then maybe they proliferate to other people. And there's a lot of debate about how welcome and useful a lot of these devices are, because they do a lot to say, to convey information about what a person should be able to do, right? Or what you have to do to be considered productive in society. And he said, look, a couple generations ago, nobody had to use a laptop. Nobody had to even use a phone. Nobody had to use the internet, but now you do. And he said, could you opt out? Sure. But you would have huge financial consequences. It would have huge educational consequences. You have huge social consequences. So is it a choice? Right? So he says, if we have these technologies that people choose to put on, what if there's this kind of arms race to the point where you have to wear them? What if they become very expensive? What if they kind of exacerbate all of these other digital divide problems that we already have that have to do with race and class and gender and all these other things? And then when I would put this to the biohackers, I would say, well, what's the danger of, you know, constantly trying to improve yourself? They would say, no, the danger is somebody who tells you you can't improve yourself, right? They would say, this is what education is about. This is what sports is about, improving the body. This is what, heck, cosmetic surgery is about. And nobody has a problem with cosmetic surgery, right? So they would say, it is an inherently human thing that we've done since the days of the sharpened flint and fire to invent technologies that improve your lot, and then other people around you have to adapt or be left out. That's just what this curious engineering maker species does. That was a lot of philosophy. And 2 minutes. But thank you for the question. It was a great question.
Here's our last question.
So I'm curious if the brain can actually interpret new input channels or if it just maps onto existing ones. Like if I'm looking at a sunset, am I seeing a false color image of that, or can I actually see beyond the visible spectrum?
Yeah, okay. So this was the big question that the book drives to. I'm going to give you a little bit of spoilers, right? So one of the questions is, a lot of the biohackers start with this magnet. They put it in their body, right? And the question is, what are they perceiving? We don't have, to our knowledge, any kind of magnetic sensing lobe or cortex in the brain or any apparatus to do this. Other animals do, we don't. Or other animals have some kind of mechanism, we don't, right? So the question is, what are they feeling? So I would say to them, is it just sense of touch? You have magnets in your fingers. You're moving things around. They would say things like, I can feel when my hard drive spools up. I can feel the electric current in the wall. I can feel one of them did a demonstration for me where he held my finger to his finger and he turned the can opener on. And I could feel his finger vibrating, the magnet vibrating, because of the electromagnetic field from the can opener, right? So the question is, what is it? And a lot of people would say, well, it's kind of like synesthesia. You know, it's two senses at once, this kind of crossover. And now, there aren't really any academics you can call up and say, what happens when you put a magnet in your finger, right? I bugged a lot of them. And what I did at the end is I kind of launched a theory, which is that it's exactly what you're talking about, which is sensory substitution, which is the idea is your brain adapts, your brain is plastic enough to adapt to novel information in its surroundings and uses an existing part of the cortex. It uses an existing input channels to process that information. And so some other examples of sensory substitution is that's how Braille essentially works, right? You use touch to create a mental image, a visual image. That is essentially, one person compared it to a radiation detector, which uses sound, right? You can't sense radiation on your own, but you can detect the sound, and from that you can get a proxy idea of where the radiation is or what the level is, right? So does that make sense? It's kind of like novel information being ported through an existing channel.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Great question.
Our thanks to Kara Platone. We also like to thank the audience here as well as our listening audience who's listening to this recording. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. You guys are wonderful.